This planet we call home, it is a total oddball. Have you wondered why it's the only one in our galaxy to sustain complex life? Something very, very weird was started 3.5 billion years ago.
So life had a chance to develop, and at some time, the evolution of the organisms and the evolution of the planet as two separate processes fused into a single, tightly coupled process, and that's really what I'm talking about is Gaia.
One way to say it is Gaia is the sum of the ecosystems that makes still another ecosystem. One way not to say it is that it's a goddess or a single organism or many of the other distortions. I think it's crucial to recognize that this is a scientific hypothesis within the realm of ordinary science, but expansionist.
About as expansive as you can get. Voices from the ABC's awesome archives, scientists James Lovelock and the late Lynn Margulis. Both mavericks of their time, both hugely influential. Hey, Natasha Mitchell with you. In this episode of Science Friction, have you heard of this big idea, Gaia?
Well, the beginnings of the Gaia hypothesis came to a British scientist, James Lovelock, when he was working for NASA at the Jet Propulsion Laboratories, Pasadena, California, in 1965, he would say.
It was a radical hypothesis that deeply polarised scientists, captivated environmentalists, and cast the Earth as one vast, self-regulating kind of superorganism.
He was employed in the beginnings of the missions that eventually sent the Viking landers to Mars in search of life on Mars. But he was thinking much more generally about how could you detect life on a planet.
On June 19th, 1976, the first Viking arrived in the vicinity of Mars after a year-long journey of more than 400 million miles.
At the time, he knew something about the atmosphere of Mars and predicted then that it was a lifeless planet. But when he looked back to the Earth, he saw this extraordinarily chemically improbable atmosphere that we live and breathe today. And that was really the beginnings of the idea, because at the same time, Lovelock knew that the composition of Earth's atmosphere had been remarkably stable over geologic periods of time. And he had this kind of eureka moment where he thought, maybe life is not just creating this unusual atmosphere, but also regulating or stabilising it. And that's the beginning of the Gaia hypothesis.
Which was this idea that our improbable planet isn't just home to billions of living organisms, but that the Earth itself must be alive as one pulsating system. Its living skin, the lakes, lands, soils, seas, and with the atmosphere above must somehow all be connected by this giant recycling system, exchanging chemicals and nutrients, materials and gases. Tim Lenton heads up the new Global Systems Institute at the University of Exeter, where he's also Professor of Climate Change and Earth System Science.
Lovelock realised that the extraordinary long life of life on Earth, 3.5 billion years, in the face of meteorite impacts and a sun that burns steadily brighter over time, demanded an explanation. I mean, life is flourishing on our planet now and has been doing for these geological eons. And he hypothesized that could only be the case because life had somehow got entwined in a great big self-regulating system that was stabilizing the whole planet.
Here's Lovelock in 1985.
The whole system is exceedingly robust. It's so robust that it's withstood the impact of no less than 30 planetesimals. Those are chunks of rock about 10 miles in diameter and hitting the Earth at 60 times the speed of sound. They are fearful events. They release 1,000 times as much energy as would be released if all of the nuclear weapons in the world today were exploded at once. So you see how tough it is. It's withstood that kind of blow not once, but 30 times.
James Lovelock, who has always said he speaks for the planet, turns 99 this week. It's really hard to summarise the breadth of his unusual career. He designed instruments that first detected ozone-depleting chlorofluorocarbons and pesticide residues in the body, big findings, in and around earlier medical research during World War II, work with NASA, and a whole host of very popular books. Microbiologist Lynn Margulis died in 2011. She transformed our understanding of the evolution of cells. Both staunchly independent thinkers, they collaborated on Gaia theory. And joining me in this episode are two of today's scientists who are breathing new life into Gaia and testing it out using computer models and other experiments. James Dyke is Associate Professor in Sustainability at the University of Southampton. He joins me with Tim Lenton. Here's Tim.
So one thing that captured my imagination when I was just a 18-year-old kid starting to think about this stuff was the realisation that the oxygen level of our atmosphere, around 21% of the atmosphere today, has been stable near that level for around 400 million years, which is only about a tenth of Earth history, but it's a crucial tenth, the last tenth. And yet all of the oxygen in the atmosphere has been completely replaced hundreds of times in that interval. Now we understand how plants on land, when they colonised the land 400 million years ago, both pushed the oxygen level up to this modern 21% and subsequently got involved in stabilising it there through, for example, what we would call feedbacks involving fires getting more ferocious if the oxygen level goes up or disappearing altogether if it drops. Another great example is how life is involved in keeping the climate cool and stabilising the climate if it gets perturbed, we would say, if it gets knocked warmer or even colder. That involves a process of the chemical weathering, the breakdown of rocks, and plants and fungi in partnership with plants and microbes in the soil are all involved in greatly speeding up the rate at which they dissolve rocks. And they do this for their own benefit, to get hold of some nutrients in the rocks. But it also has this inadvertent consequence of taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and creating a much more potent long-term stabilizer of carbon dioxide and temperature.
So there's this constant relationship, feedback going on between living organisms on the planet and the planet's bigger systems, atmospheric or otherwise. Tim, why couldn't all life on Earth, this incredibly complex system of living organisms on the surface of a planet, why couldn't it be a case of cosmological luck, not some sort of organism like Gaia at work? And by organism, we're talking metaphorically here. But, you know, the fact that the Earth sustains life might be just the luck of where Earth sits in relation to the sun in the cosmos. The fact that we can have water on the Earth as a result, and that sustains life. Just a probabilistic possibility.
Well, undoubtedly, there's some degree of luck in finding ourselves where we do on our planet amidst a flourishing biosphere that's been going for 3.5 billion years. This planet is at roughly the right distance from its parent star to have had liquid water when the planet and the star began. But when we look at the Earth today, we see all these mechanisms through which life bootstraps itself into a state of greater flourishing, by which I mean life is profoundly recycling all the materials it needs to support its own productivity. There are massive exchanges of carbon dioxide, oxygen, and other gases between the living biosphere and the atmosphere all the time that are helping boost the productivity of the planet. The same thing is true for all the major nutrients that life depends upon. So it's very clear to me that life is involved in perpetuating itself in a global sense to a massive scale. And at the same time, we have plenty of evidence that life is now thoroughly entwined in the mechanisms that regulate the climate of the planet on long timescales, on geological timescales. So we can't even attribute the fact that the Earth is still cool at 15 degrees on average with liquid water. We can't attribute that to just physics and chemistry. Life's played a big part in keeping the planet cool as the sun has got steadily brighter over time.
There's this self-regulating process going on. To what end point? You refer to stability, but what is stability? What's the optimum kind of equilibrium around which the Earth circulates, in a sense, or exists?
This is part of the challenge with the Gaia hypothesis, because it's hard to define a sort of single, shared, universal optimum for all life forms. But it would appear that the Earth now is regulating itself in a state that helps what we might be tempted to call the dominant life forms, so multicellular complex life forms, including plants, animals, and fungi, in a state that allows them to persist. And these more complex life forms, including us, tend to have tighter habitability needs than simpler bacterial life forms.
James Dyke, the very expression Gaia, it comes from Greek mythology, the mother goddess who presided over the earth. And surreally, that term was suggested to James Lovelock by William Golding, of all people, author of The Lord of the Flies. How controversial has that name itself been? Because it seems to have been co-opted by all sorts of interest groups.
They are interesting interest groups. So I don't know to what extent Jim Lovelock regrets using the name Gaia. It certainly makes a great deal of sense, but it is the case that Gaia, Gaia theory, Gaia hypothesis, is used by lots of different organizations, groups, or individuals for lots of different reasons or purposes. And what's very ironic is that Lovelock himself has got some very quite strident opinions about some aspects of the environmental movement. So he's famously pro-nuclear, for example. He has a view of technological innovation which requires humanity to have large amounts of energy. He's diametrically opposed to some people who think that Gaia means that the Earth is motherly, or that we have some kind of maybe spiritual or quasi-religious connection with the Mother Earth or the planetary system.
People were really drawn to that kind of mystical notion that Gaia might be like a kind of a conscious agent or a god-like entity.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's perfectly understandable. If you think about what the initial Gaia hypothesis asked us to imagine, is that we are intimately connected to everything that's not just alive now, but arguably everything that's ever lived, because everything that's ever lived has made the Earth what it is today. So there's a deep sense of connection that we have across species, across taxa. We are all different manifestations of an unfolding, evolving, dynamic, complex life form that it's ultimately transformed a planet, and in doing so made that planet more habitable for life. So it's easy to see how that could have different spiritual or religious interpretations.
But the environmental movement latched onto it too, because it placed us inside a bigger system, didn't it?
Yeah.
Not independent of the system. It challenged the whole great chain of being notion that humans were just one under the angels and a god, and all other species were somehow below us, that instead we were interdependent.
That's absolutely crucial. I think fundamentally Gaia puts us as just one set of actors among many in this quasi-living system, where the other agents, microbes included, are crucial to our being here. They have their own goals, if you like, which they work towards just as we do.
What Gaia theory does is embed humans within the Earth system. And it makes us appreciate just how reliant we are on the Earth system for the things that we all ultimately rely on. So in contemporary ecological parlance, that's sometimes called ecosystem services, the idea that ecosystems provide things for us, whether it's fiber or fuel or food or climate regulation. And it's an appreciation that whilst we may be able to produce wealth by extracting resources and then dumping our pollution into some kind of environmental sink, there are ultimately limits to that. There are limits for the regeneration of natural resources, and there are limits for the ability of the Earth system to essentially sequester or store our pollution. So I think Gaia has been very important for that contemporary or modern environmental movement, because it shows just how tightly coupled we are to the planetary system.
I mean, aside from the scientific questions, which we'll get to, environmental scientists were somewhat disturbed by the Gaia hypothesis because it might make people complacent in thinking that Gaia means we can do anything to the planet's ecosystem and it will adapt over time. It will find its own new healthy equilibrium based on whatever inputs we create.
But the crucial point is it might find a healthy equilibrium without us. And hopefully most of us have got some degree of self-interest in the long-term persistence of our own species, if not ourselves as individuals. The other part of the answer is there are these pivotal moments in the history of Gaia in which some new biological innovation comes along that ultimately completely transforms the whole system, Gaia, into a new mode of operation. And perhaps, just perhaps, humans are the beginning of one of those revolutions. Whether we'll live to see the consequences of it seems to be an open question at the moment.
Can you give me an example of those sorts of big perturbations in the system?
Yeah, so the most famous one is the origin of photosynthesis as we know it, which gives off oxygen as a waste product. It evolved in some beautiful little creatures called cyanobacteria. But it created the biggest chemical change in the history of the planet. Around 2.5 billion years ago, the planet had an event called the Great Oxidation, in which chemically the atmosphere was changed irreversibly to a more oxygen-rich state. It created all kind of rusted iron deposits, some of which are gracing Australia today. And it never went back. And that set the scene for the evolution of more complex cells, which scientists call eukaryote cells, out of which you and I and all fungi and plants and other animals are made.
And that was such a dramatic shift. What would have had to have happened over time in the Earth systems to re-establish a new equilibrium that was accommodating of huge oxygen levels?
Well, the crucial thing is when such a large shift happens, parts of the planetary machinery organism, like the carbon cycle, tend to get completely out of whack. And at that time, we see a string of ice ages, including a possible snowball Earth event in which we think the whole planet may have frozen over. And basically, it typically would take many millions of years for a mixture of evolution by natural selection and the establishment of what we call new feedback loops to re-stabilize the planet. That's what we see then at the Great Oxidation. It's what we see in a second revolution more recently in Earth history, around 600 million years ago. And right now, if we're causing a kind of revolutionary change to the planet, the crucial thing is we don't want to have to wait for many millions of years for natural selection, etc., to find a new stable configuration, because we'll be long gone if we have to wait that long.
You and I both. Environmental scientists Tim Lenton and James Dyke say their experimental models are building a more complete picture of how this idea of Gaia might actually work, how those feedback loops connecting all life on our planet operate. But surely computer models can only take us so far. How do you test out Gaia in real-world experiments or beyond?
We're getting tantalisingly close now to be able to observe the composition of not just one, but a large number of planets around distant stars. And so we're beginning to be able to begin to compute the number of other biospheres that may be in the universe. And if we can understand some of the evolution of those planets around those other stars, then we can begin to make, you know, informed guesses as to how stable those biospheres may have been over time. But that's the very, very largest. At the very, very smallest, I suppose we'd be looking at more bacterial evolution. So there's been some very exciting work on looking at the dynamics between bacteria and their environment, because bacteria evolve very, very quickly. And it's certainly the case on Earth that, you know, all the important biogeochemical cycles, carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen, are importantly driven by bacterial as well as fungal colonies. And so we have the opportunity to produce these sort of microcosm experiments. Imagine a large jar with nutrients, with energy input, perhaps in the form of sunlight, with a diverse bacterial biota. And then what we could do is set up a series of experiments and see, in the first instance, what happens. Do robust recycling networks evolve? If they do they also stabilize environmental conditions? If they do, how robust is that homeostasis? If you begin to perturb it, make it warmer or cooler, make it lighter or darker, if you start to increase or decrease certain values of nutrient, we could then be able to, in real time, identify all the different feedback loops which are ultimately responsible for the system level homeostasis that we would be observing in that little microcosm.
Yeah, what is homeostasis exactly? What does that mean?
In simple terms, it's the idea that when you hit a system, it bounces back to where it started from. And in fact, it bounces back perhaps quicker than you were expecting if it's a healthy homeostatic system.
When Jim Lovelock first proposed the Gaia hypothesis, there was nothing at all that could begin to explain how that system level homeostasis happened. And so I think in part, the decades since he came up with that insight has been to try to explore the processes and the evolution of the planetary system that could produce that form of homeostasis.
Tim Lenton, what about humans?
Exactly.
You're both focused on climate change scenarios. Where do humans and our influence on the Earth as an ecosystem fit into the Gaia hypothesis and its story?
We are here. We're conscious. We're aware that not only are we here, but we're now collectively transforming the planet. We're changing the climate. We've changed other major cycles like nitrogen and phosphorus even more than we've changed the carbon cycle. So we might seem like an anti-Gaia in the sense we've evolved within the system and we're driving it away from what was a fairly stable configuration. But remember that in the history of Gaia or the Earth, there have been these occasional times where some new biology, some new innovation drove the planet away from stability that had persisted for eons. We may be the latest example of that. In other words, we may be the beginning of another revolution that could transform the Earth. But the crucial thing is, if we want this revolution to end well, we have to use consciousness, our self-awareness, which is the new an interesting and different thing now that's in Gaia, is the fact that it's got the self-awareness in a sense through us. We have to use that wisely and I think learn the lessons of the biosphere past to build a sustainable future that's powered by basically sustainable energy and a much more efficient recycling of all the materials we need to support our civilizations now and for the future. In that way, we could avoid going through the ringer of millions of years of tumultuous change that we might be precipitating if we just carry on what's called business as usual and driving climate change ever further.
James, how do you see humans fitting into this story of Gaia that you've been trying to put numbers to?
It's really interesting to consider to what extent we can really understand the operation of the planetary system and to what extent do we actually need to. So people make the case that the most complex system in the known universe is the human brain. It's composed of billions of neurons. It has countless trillions of possible configurable states. But that doesn't stop us really understanding brains very well. And we can invoke evolutionary arguments for that because understanding how other human beings interact and what their thoughts are, their intentions are really important for the formation and evolution of a sociable species such as Homo sapiens. So we are at this moment in time faced with the prospect of needing to understand how our planetary system functions with regards to us. So it's a very human-centric perspective. We need to understand just enough in order to ensure that we have a future. The absence of civilizations within our own galaxy, at least, leads to an interesting, further development of the Gaia hypothesis, I suppose, which is that if you need billions of years of planetary and biological evolution to produce the conditions required for complex life, such as us, which then produce technology, which then produces a form of technology which has planetary scale consequences. I mean, humans now are a geological force. We won't have much time to figure out what to do with that planetary scale power, because if we get it wrong, then we're going to disappear. And so there's some speculation as to the reason why we don't see the galaxy teeming with other extraterrestrial civilizations is not because it's hard to get life emerging on other planets or maybe even complex life, but there might be a very short window of opportunity by which a technologically advanced civilization has to figure out how to truly interact on a sustainable nature with the planet system from which it's evolved.
Get your head around that, I dare you. Associate Professor James Dyke from the University of Southampton, Professor Tim Lenton from the University of Exeter. Let's give the last words to James Lovelock from 1989.
It's not that the Earth will look after any mess that we make and will clear up after us like some nanny. Gaia of the Greeks, the ancient Earth goddess, had an awful reputation. She was supposed to have eaten her children. And I think this is very apposite because it's just what Gaia will do to us if we mess up the planet.
Putting it bluntly, James Lovelock, he turns 99 this week. Tweet me your thoughts at Natasha Mitchell. Spread the word about our podcast. Subscribe your friends. Science Friction is produced by myself and Maria Tickle, studio engineer John Jacobs, and the executive producer, Gaia.